And I came across a Cornishman. He was ripped from his shoulder to his stomach with shrapnel. His inside was out on the ground in a pool of blood. He said, "Shoot me." Before we could draw a revolver to shoot him, he was beyond all human aid. He died. In 30 seconds he died, and he just said one word, "Mother." And that haunted me all my life.
The voice of Harry Patch, labelled "The Last Fighting Tommy," someone who knew firsthand what it was like to be part of the First World War killing fields. He died some years ago. 111 years after the great powers drew up their might and smashed into one another, we again recall the horror of it all, although for many it is now a page in a history book. But others are dying now every day in battlefields new and battlefields which have been killing people for centuries the world over. But the sheer scale of the slaughter in the trenches draws us back there every year. As early as August 1914, the French, using old-fashioned methods of warfare, were butchered in the battles on the frontier in the Ardennes and at Charleroi. On August 22nd, it's estimated 27,000 French soldiers were killed. As lines were drawn across France and Belgium, the scene had been set for 4 years of military misery.
How are you feeling, darling?
Not all that good, Blackadder. Rather hoped I'd get through the whole show. Go back to work at Pratt & Sons. Keep wicket for the Croydon gentleman. Married Doris. Made a note in my diary on the way here. Simply says, bugger.
The sun's shining brightly this morning in the churchyard of the small church in St. Mark's. The leaves, as you can hear, are thickly gathered around the gravestones, something that seems to reflect a time when we recall the young people who died, leaves falling from trees. But here, let me just cross over the graveyard and take you to the front of the church. For in the front of the church, on the left-hand side of the doorway, is a memorial stone on the wall and lists the names of the people who died, who came from St. Mark's, who died between 1914 and 1918. James Hulsell, Stanley Kenyuk, George Ledger, Fred Springthorpe, and two names in particular, Lieutenant Corporal Andrew Speedy and Private Peter Speedy. That on the wall of the small church. Let's just walk across to the other side of the graveyard now. In between the stones and the plots, through the leaves again until we come across here, about two-thirds of the way across the graveyard, to a memorial stone which, although obviously is quite old, is in immaculate condition. And it reads, "In loving memory of Peter, son of Peter and Sarah Speedy of Ballacroke, who was killed in action in France, January the 17th, aged 31. Some other names, and then also of Andrew, their son, who died from wounds received in France, July 11th, 1920, aged 31 years. What must have been the effect on the Speedy family? The deaths of two youngish members of their family. No life spreading out into old age, no grandchildren, no long evenings by the fireside with their family. And critically, during their working lives, no working in the fields to bring home the harvest. These two were among the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, goodness sake, that were scythed down between 1914 and 1918, for in some cases just a few yards gained. Desperately sad, and indeed must mean at the time a devastating blow for this small community.
I sit here down by your graveside and rest for a while in the warm summer sun. I've been walking all day and I'm nearly done. I see by your gravestone you were only 19 when you joined the great fallen in 1916. Well, I hope you died quick, and I hope you died clean. Willie McBride, was it slow and obscene? Did they beat the drum slowly? Did they play the fife lowly? Did they sound the death march as they lowered you down? Did the band play the last post and chorus? Play the flowers of the forest. Did you leave a young wife or a sweetheart behind? In some faithful heart is your memory enshrined. Though I know that you died back in 1916, in that faithful heart are you forever 19? Or are you a stranger without even a name, enclosed in forever behind a glass pane? In an old photograph torn and tattered and stained and faded to yellow in a brown leather frame, did they be drum slowly, did they play the fife lowly? Did they sound the death march as they mowed you down? Did the band play the last post and chorus? Did the pipes play the flowers of the forest? The sun shines bright on the green fields of France. The warm summer breeze makes the red poppies dance. The trenches are scattered long under the plough. No gas, no barbed wire, there's no gunfire now. But here in this graveyard it is still no man's land. The countless white crosses are mute where they stand. To man's blind indifference to his fellow man, and a whole generation that were butchered and damned. Did they beat the drum slowly? Did they play the fife lowly? Did they sound the death march as they lowered you down? Did the band play the last post and chorus? Did the pipes play the flowers of the forest? I can't help but wonder, young Willie McBride, do those who lie here really know why they died? Did they believe believe when they answered the call? Did they really believe that this war would end wars? The sorrow, the suffering, the glory, the shame, the killing and the dying were all done in vain. For young Willie McBride, it all happened again and again and again and again and again. Did they beat the drum slowly? Did they play the fife lowly? Did they sound the death march as they lowered you down? Did the band play the last postern chorus? Did the pipes play the flowers of the forest? Did they beat the drum slowly? Did they play the fife lowly? Did they sound death march as they lowered you down? Did the band play the last postern chorus? Did the pipes play the flowers of the forest?
A lament for a young fallen man, unknown to the singer, just his age and name. Many people have over the years come to gravesites to remember, much as some will do today, although less and less will be able to recall those who marched away in 1940. Many, of course, came back with the scars of war evident. This is one of the best known of the laments for those who lived out their days crippled by war.
Now, when I was a young man, I carried me pack and I lived the free life on the roller. From the Murray's green basin to the dusty outback, oh, I waltzed my Matilda all over. Then in 1915, my country said, son, it's time stop rambling, there's work to be done. So they gave me a tin hat and they gave me a gun and they marched me away to the war. And the band played Waltzing Matilda as the ship pulled away from the quay. And amidst all the cheers, the flag waving and tears, we sailed off for Gallipoli. How well I remember that terrible day, how our blood stained the sand and the water, and of how in that hell that they called Sula Bay, we were butchered like lambs at the slaughter. Johnny Turk, he was waiting, he primed himself well. He showered us with bullets and he rained us with shell. And in 5 minutes flat, he'd blown us all to hell. Nearly blew us right back to Australia. But the band played Waltzing Matilda when we stopped to bury our slain. We buried ours and the Turks buried theirs. And we started all over again. And those that were left, we tried to survive in that mad world of blood, death and fire. And for 10 weary weeks I kept myself alive, though around me the corpses piled higher. Then a big Turkish shell knocked me off over the head, and when I woke up in me hospital bed and saw what it had done, oh, I wished I was dead. Never knew there was worse things than dying, for I'll go no more waltzing Matilda all around the green bush far and free, to hum tent and pegs a man needs both legs. No more waltzing Matilda for me. So they gathered the crippled, the wounded, the maimed, and they shipped us back home to Australia. The armless, the legless, the blind, the insane, those proud wounded heroes of Suvla. And as our ship sank into circular quay, I looked at the place where me legs used to be, and thank Christ there was nobody waiting for me to grieve, to mourn, or to pity. But the band played Waltzing Matilda as they carried us down the gangway. But nobody cheered, they just stood and stared, then they turned their faces away. And so now, every April, I sit on me porch and I watch the parade pass before me. I see my old comrades, how proudly they march, reviving old dreams of past glories. The old men march slowly, old bones stiff and sore, the tired old heroes from a forgotten war. And the young people ask, what are they marching for? And I ask myself the same question. But the band plays Waltzing Matilda, the old men still answer the call, but as year follows year, more old men disappear. Someday no one will march there at all. Waltzing Matilda, waltzing Matilda, you'll come waltzing Matilda with me. And their ghosts may be heard as they march by that billabong. You come a waltzing Matilda with me.
The island also had mature officers heading to war. In 1940, one came back with a VC, but never mentioned it. His name was Robert Kane. In a few minutes, his story told by the archivist at the Arnhem Museum. First, though, let's head south on this island.
Most people come down to Castletown via the main road, but one or two people, quite a few, I suppose, go on the coast road. Beautiful view here around the bay. onto Douglas Street and then into Castletown via the museum, the Peggy Museum, into Castletown by the back door, if I can put it that way. But in doing so, they'll probably pass a house with a plaque on it that they may not know about. And the plaque reads this: Major Robert Henry Kane, VC, Hero of Arnhem, lived here 1972 to 1974. We don't have that many blue plaques around the island, and this denotes an extraordinary man, a man who went to war because he felt he needed to serve his country, and came back again and never said anything about what happened during that war. Although what did happen was he came into Arnhem as part of Operation Market Garden. He fought with his regiment at Arnhem and carried out some extraordinary exploits against the enemy. And as I say, his daughter was married to Jeremy Clarkson. She didn't know anything about what he'd done during the war until after he died and people started explaining what a remarkable man he was.
As far as Major Kane's part, it is extraordinary when you read it. It's almost as if he was obviously a marvellous officer, but for a stage he was with the rest of the men fighting, and then something happened that made him really angry. It's almost like that. He suddenly exploded, and then after that, he, no matter what appeared, Tiger tanks or whatever, he just grabbed a weapon, appeared usually, one of these anti-tank weapons, and just went for it.
Yes, but I quite agree what you said there. He was a marvellous type of officer.
Inspirational.
Inspirational, definitely. Very decisive. But he rose to the occasion as well. And when he had got as far as, say, 1.25 miles off Arnhem Bridge, and they were driven back, he took 100 men under his command, not all of his own regiment, of his own battalion, and then came into a wooded area between Oosterbeek and Arnhem, and found that they couldn't dig in because the roots of the trees. And I think being confronted then by self-propelled guns and Tiger tanks, he was just bloody mad.
Up to just a few years ago, there were still those on the island who recalled their part in World War II, and in particular the retreat and evacuation from Dunkirk. Getting off the beaches was the final part of what was, for many Manx soldiers who'd never seen action before, a truly appalling experience.
We lined up, and a lifeboat came in for some of our corps, and which was by then sadly depleted. And we were rowed out. We rowed ourselves out to a Dutch freighter called the Dromedary, and we got away on her at daylight, and got to Margate on the Sunday morning, June the 4th.
To look then, when we got onto the ship, and to look ahead of us and see that wonderful sight, the white cliffs of Dover, which meant that we were coming home.
We were all up on the rail as if we were going on a trip round the island, and looking back, it was just a pile of smoke and fire. And he was still having a go at the Stukas, having a go at this half channel coming back. So could he see us off on the way back, us and a lot more people.
Just when we got onto the trawler, or what we would call a trawler, we went as quick as we could to get our head down because we were tired. And we got on where they keep the ropes up, what's known as the forecastle on the boat, right up in the bow. And we lay on the hawsers there, and one of the crew came along, and he had a cup of tea for both of us, huge mug of tea, and a very thick sandwich with dripping, with beef dripping from it. And oh, wasn't it wonderful? It was marvellous, that.
When Napoleon lay at Boulogne for a year with his flat bottom boats and his grand army, he was told by someone, there are bitter weeds in England. There are certainly a great many more of them since the British expeditionary force returned. Sir, I have myself full confidence that if all do their duty, if nothing is neglected, and if the best arrangements are made, as they are being made, we shall prove ourselves once more able to defend our island home, to ride out the storm of war, and to outlive the menace of tyranny, if necessary for years, if necessary alone.
We got onto a train very quickly off when we were at Ramsgate, and we started a very, very slow journey up, right up through England, but going very, very slow. And it must have been a Saturday afternoon, because what surprised us, we were playing cricket, beautiful white cricket apparel, playing cricket. And we'd come from that, which we couldn't say again then.
We women teach our little sons how wrong and how ignoble blows are. School and church support our precepts and inoculate the growing minds with thoughts of love and peace. Let dogs delight to bark and bite, we say, but human beings with immortal souls must rise above the methods of the brute and walk with reason and self-control. And then, dear God, you men, you wise, strong men, our self-announced superiors in brain, our peers in judgment, you go forth to war. You leap at one another, mutilate and starve and kill your fellow men, and ask the world's applause for such heroic deeds. You boast and strut, and if no song is sung, no laudatory epic writ in blood, telling how many widows you have made, why then, Penforce, you say our bards are dead and inspiration sleeps to wake no more. And we, the women, we whose lives you are, what can we do but sit in silent homes and wait and suffer? Not for us the blare of trumpets and the bugle's call to arms, for us no waving banners, no supreme triumphant hour of conquest. Ours the slow dread torture of uncertainty, each day the bootless battle with the same despair. And when at best your victories reach our ears, there reaches with them to our pitying hearts the thought of countless homes made desolate and other women weeping for their dead. O men, wise men, superior being, say, is there no substitute for war in this great age and air? If you answer no, then let us rear our children to be wolves and teach them from the cradle how to kill. Why should we women take waste our time and work in talking peace when men declare for war?